You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us here at the University of California. I'm Mike O'Hanlon from Brookings. We have a Brookings panel today to discuss the issue of ISIL, or as you prefer, you say tomato, I say tomato, ISIS, IS. Ken prefers the Arabic name, as we'll hear in a moment. In any event, we're going to talk about this very acute threat to certainly regional security in the Middle East, and then the question of just how much is it a threat to the United States as well. And that will be our topic for today. We're thrilled. I think we have the perfect team here to kick things off, and we have a succinctness and a cogency. One of our top experts, each one of whom can talk about Iraq and Syria and the broader region, but each one will kick off the conversation with one country or the other. Then we'll talk amidst ourselves for a little bit up front, even though I recognize that the viewing may be a little difficult. And then we'll have a discussion. And maybe during the discussion we'll come up individually to the podium if we have longer comments to make so that we can engage better with you all. So again, thank you for being here. I'm Mike O'Hanlon. I direct the Center on 21st Century Security and Intelligence at Brookings. Actually, I co-direct it, but my co-director took a little leave of absence. He's now directing the coalition against ISIL, retired General John Allen. So we thought it was a reasonable basis for a little unpaid vacation in his case. We have panelists Ken Pollack and Salman Sheikh. Salman is in our Doha Center. Both of them work for the Center on Middle East Policy at Brookings, also part of the Foreign Policy Program. Salman runs our Doha Center, which we're very proud of, and it's been under some scrutiny in recent weeks in the newspaper and elsewhere. I just want to say I think you'll see for yourselves today, if you aren't already familiar with what he's doing, that it is remarkable work. And let me just state clearly for the record, it is unconstrained in any way by any outside influence, including the government of Qatar, allegations to the contrary notwithstanding. But in any event, we're not here today to talk about Brookings versus the New York Times. We're here to talk about the world against ISIS and ISIL. And what I would like to do, therefore, is to ask Salman to talk a bit about Syria. And he does so as a scholar, but also as a participant in a peace process or a political negotiation that he has been trying to catalyze and trying to help spark in his job at Doha and in his broader interests. He has a background with the United Nations, working on various peace efforts in the broader Middle East, and I think you'll see the sophistication and the familiarity he has with a lot of the groups, a lot of their points of view, and he'll go second. Kicking things off will be my good friend and longstanding colleague at Brookings, Ken Pollack, who, as many of you know, has served in the government at the intelligence community and the NSC in previous parts of his career, is very well known for his writings on the broader Middle East. He is particularly well known for his writings on Iraq, on Iran, and Syria, although certainly he's written about broader Arab political reform, broader Arab military performance and history as well. And so what we're going to do is begin with Ken. We'll each talk now for 5 to 7 minutes. Ken will start primarily with Iraq, Salman primarily with Syria, and then we'll combine the conversation. Obviously, we're all aware these problems are intermixed and non-separable. So the fact that we're asking each one to begin with a piece is designed to set the foundations to build towards a coherent strategy and a coherent integrated discussion. But I think we'll start in that fashion. So without further ado, Ken, over to you.
Thank you, Mike. It is great to be sharing a podium once again with Michael O'Hanlon and Salman Sheikh. It's great to be appearing before all of you, although in a new venue. So I can't say you have heard me say from this podium. I'll have to say, as you've heard me say from other podiums. What's nice for me is I actually get to be the good news guy, right? This is a rarity for me. It has been years since I've been able to stand up and say, I'm going to talk to you about Iraq, and Iraq is the good news part of the story. Obviously, I'm being somewhat facetious. Iraq is the good news part of the story only insofar as we compare it to Syria, where there are even greater problems, where there's even more work to be done. But on the Iraq side of things, I think it is worth taking note of the fact that we've had some very important developments, and they have been, by and large, positive developments. The Obama administration, after steadfastly doing the wrong thing for 6 years, suddenly came around and realized, okay, that isn't working. We're going to have to do the right thing. And I think that they deserve credit for recognizing that. They fundamentally changed their approach to Iraq. And that has borne real fruit. Right? We do have a new prime minister in Iraq, and we do have a new political process, and it is far from completion, and it is far from achieving what we hope it will and what it needs to if Iraq is going to continue to make progress. But there has been progress so far. There is a new government. There is a new cabinet, mostly. There is movement on a whole variety of different issues. And we're hearing different Iraqis talking about the political process in ways that we have not heard them talk about the political process since 2010. That's all important. That's all positive. That, unfortunately, though, is kind of where the good news ends, because we're now at a point where we have made some important progress. Oh, and I should point out the Daesh offensives have been stopped around Baghdad. They've been stopped toward Erbil. They've been stopped at Mosul Dam. To some extent, they've been stopped in Diyala. And even Anbar, where they've made some progress, no longer are they pushing southeastward. They're still taking villages in other parts, but the major thrust has also been largely stalemated. That's also important progress. But now comes the hard part, and there's still a lot of other important elements that need to be taken care of, things that we need to be watching as we move forward. And here, you know, I was trying to decide whether the problems are political, whether they're military, and there I find it impossible to disentangle, because the military is political and the political is military in this part of the world, and in particular in this conflict. But just a few things that I think we all need to be watching very carefully as we move forward. And it's where this intermingling of the military and the political really become very acute, because what needs to happen now in Iraq is a military campaign to evict Daesh from western and northern Iraq. But that can't be a purely military campaign. It has to be a political military one. And every aspect, every step of that military campaign is going to have critical political overtones, overtones that the parties themselves in Baghdad are acutely aware of. And it has the potential to complicate, if not potentially derail, this military campaign. So the administration recognized reality, recognized that the Sunnis wanted their own military forces, and were deeply skeptical of the idea of allowing the Iraqi army, which it sees now as effectively another Shia militia, as coming back into their areas and liberating their areas. And the administration recognized that reality. It's even come up with a nice term, the Iraqi National Guard units. Those are going to be the Sunni formations, which will be married up to Iraqi army formations, which may very well be heavily dominated by Shia. And for the moment, that's a workable way of moving forward. But, of course, the rubber is going to hit the road when the boots hit the sand and when the tank treads hit the sand. How are these units going to operate? Will Iraqi army units be allowed to push on and liberate Sunni cities, whether it be Tikrit or, you know, as we get farther north, even up into Mosul, into Fallujah, you know, places that are acutely sensitive for the Sunni community and who so far have very consistently said they don't want to see the Iraqi army in those places. They want only their own formations with American backing. And that's, of course, not something that the United States necessarily wants to see, but we're going to have to figure out a way to make all of this work, either to have combined formations of some kind or to somehow broker who goes where and when and how, and that's going to be very, very difficult in the days to come. Beyond that, there's a very big question lying at the end of the road of what the future government of Iraq looks like. Right? And it's not a question that can simply be put off until the rest of Iraq has been reconquered, because the fact of the matter is that Sunni, Shia, Kurd, all of them are thinking about that right now. And their responses, their reactions, their cooperation in the fight to evict Daesh from western Iraq is going to be predicated on their thinking and their goals for that future state. The Shia would very much like to see Iraq go back to the period, as one Shia put it to me, basically, the Maliki era without Maliki. right? Could we recreate the moment when Iraq was no longer occupied by the United States, was dominated by a coalition led by the Shia, but remove Maliki's autocratic tendencies from that mix and replay it in a way that, as many see, should have been done but wasn't because of Maliki's paranoia and his own various personality problems that he brought to the job? That is not what most Sunni political leaders are interested in, not what they're willing to accept. They want a very decentralized Iraq. As several put it to me at various points in time, they want what the Kurds had. And that may even be hard because who knows what the Kurds will have at the end of the road. And we're hoping to have all of these different groups cooperating. And, of course, for all of them, any military decision they make can become a precedent for that ultimate political decision, that ultimate political solution. So if the Sunnis allow Shia formations, Iraqi army formations, into the west, into the north, does that mean that in that future state there will be an Iraqi army that will control all of the territory of Iraq? Or will it be that the Iraqi army is only a Shia force left in the south of Iraq, and the Sunni governorates have their own militias, their own National Guard formations, which are the primary security providers in their areas, effectively what the Kurds have with the Peshmerga and what many Sunnis have wanted? There are other problems as well. I think on the Shia side, we more or less have a situation where most Shia political leaders are fairly confident in this government. On the Sunni side, much less so. And we've seen a greater fragmentation among the Sunni community in terms of tribal leadership, in terms of political leadership. It's much harder these days to say who leads the Sunnis and who speaks for them. Our friend John Allen really has his work cut out figuring out who it is who's going to speak for the Sunnis. And a last point that we ought to think about, and there are many others, but I'm going to finish off on this one because we want to keep our opening remarks brief, is this question of at what point can we start to count on the Sunni tribes and other Sunni groups to turn on Daesh? Right? From almost the minute after Mosul fell, I and a number of others, Mark Kimmitz here, Mark probably got these phone calls too, but a number of us started getting phone calls from Sunni sheikhs, from Sunni political leaders, from other intermediaries, all saying to us, please understand, we hate Daesh. We have no interest in allowing them to rule our lands, but we hate Maliki more. Once you get rid of Maliki, we'll all turn on Daesh. And I think that when they said it, they meant it. That represented their heartfelt aspirations. But, of course, Maliki is gone, and some tribes have turned on Maliki, but not a whole lot. And there's still many others who have not done so, and some who are continuing to fight alongside of Daesh and the other Sunni militants. And the truth of the matter is it would be very difficult for them to move. There was a piece, I think, in the Times today or yesterday that I thought illustrated it very nicely. How do you equip, train, enable these forces to move against Daesh at a moment when Daesh is largely in control of their tribal lands? How do we make contact with them? How do we bring their fighters out to where we can train them, arm them, equip them, and send them back in? These are enormously complicated problems, made even more so by the prior point that I made, when it's not clear who actually is running the Sunni world, the Sunni part of Iraq, where there is no unified leadership that can make these kinds of contacts and broker different arrangements. And it's not clear which tribe will actually report to which other tribe or which other tribal leader. All of these things still need to be sorted out. So at one level, I think we've made real progress, taken some very important steps forward, but there's still a very long way to go.
And while you're up there, if you don't mind, we've been asked to do most of our speaking here, so I'll pose two quick clarifying questions while you're still there. One is, all of your excellent comments make it clear why the following question is unanswerable, but I'm going to ask it anyway, which is about how long would this take if it worked the way you hope? And then secondly, you're mentioning the calls from the tribal sheikhs makes me a question occur to me. When we, both you and I, but especially you and other Iraq experts, know a lot of people who got killed by al-Qaeda in Iraq back in the 06-07 period especially and before, and there were a lot of tribal leaders being taken out. To what extent is that happening? Or, in other words, are we losing that kind of tribal structure even as we speak with each passing day and week and month? is the basis for a Sunni resistance within Iraq being decimated because ISIL has anticipated where we all want to go? Or is much of this leadership surviving for the moment, which I don't mean to suggest would be a case for complacency, but it would still be interesting to know.
Let me answer your second question first, because in some ways it gets back to your first question. My sense is, and again, I want to be very careful about this because I don't think that we have great information on this. The U.S. government hopefully has better information, but I don't think that they have terrific information either. And, you know, there may be others with better, but again, I don't think it's complete, because that's the problem, is it's very fragmented. It's hard to know what's actually going on in those areas controlled by Daesh and the other Sunni militant groups. But as best I can tell, it seems to be the case that Daesh certainly does go after the tribal leaders who resist them, but that it hasn't embarked on kind of a widespread campaign to try to decapitate the Sunni tribal leadership, perhaps because they don't ever intend to. At another level, it may just be because they don't yet feel strong enough to do so. And I certainly think that that's the case, that, we certainly have gotten very frightened by these guys, but the truth is they aren't terribly many in number. There are a lot more Sunni tribesmen out there than there are Daesh fighters. Again, they're only part of a larger coalition. I don't think they're in any position to start decapitating the Sunni tribal leadership, which would immediately turn that very big swath of the population against them in a way that, frankly, they don't need right now. They've got enough enemies, which kind of brings to the second question of how long. And you're right, that's an almost impossible question to answer. But I'm going to answer it in this way, that I actually suspect that the United States, at least I'm going to say this, I hope that this is the case, because it would be the smart thing to do, but I'm going to give them credit and say that this is what they're doing. I don't think they want to move too fast, because I think that they recognize that they need to sort out these political questions first. I mean, I think the truth is that if President Obama really wanted to, if his goal simply were to smash Daesh, if that were really his goal, right, destroy, degrade ISIL, that's what he said. If that's all he wanted to do, we could start backing the Shia militias right this minute. And they have a fair amount of capability with U.S. air power to do a great deal of damage. I mean, the Shia militias are big, they're extensive, they're vicious, they're very committed, they've got experience. They can go and brawl with these guys. And with the addition of U.S. air power, I think that they could do a lot of damage right now. But I think that it's very clear the U.S. doesn't want to do that. And I think that what you're going to see is a U.S., and certainly a U.S. military that's going to say, give us 6 to 12 months to retrain the Iraqi security forces and now to train these National Guard formations so that when we start to roll back Daesh, we're doing it the right way politically. We're doing it with, my guess is what the administration wants to do, the military wants to do, is composite units. So we have a National Guard battalion and an Iraqi army battalion, and if there's a Shia militia battalion trailing behind, we'll just kind of pretend they're not there, but we'll know that they're there. And that's the right way to do it. And I think the real trick, and one of the key issues for John Allen, for General Austin, ultimately for the president, is there's undoubtedly going to be a military political tension here. And it's something that you see in almost all these kinds of wars. And, heck, we saw it in World War II, right, with, the political leaders saying, you got to do something. We have to show the people of Europe that we're not just standing still, right? And Eisenhower and Marshall and the other generals saying, no, we're not doing D-Day until we're absolutely ready to go. I think we're going to have the same situation in Iraq, where political leaders are going to be saying, you can't just leave Western Iraq under Daesh control. You've got to do something. And the military leaders saying, we're not ready. And we don't know how that's going to work out, right? And it may be that they try to do both at the same time. Certainly they're going to do this air campaign. They might try to do some special forces operations as a way of showing people, hey, Daesh is not going to be in control of Western and Northern Iraq forever, but we're going to make sure that we're going to do it the right way.
Excellent. Thank you. So, Salman, over to you, my friend.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's lovely to be in Washington. City I love. I particularly love this towpath that you've got where I can go running every morning. Very different to Doha, I'll tell you that. I've been asked to speak about Syria and about 6-7 minutes, so here goes. I'll try and divide it up into sort of three sort of sections. The first, actually, to continue slightly the good news thing, the coalition, the miracle coalition that was formed with Arab states, which I think many of us were surprised at the extent to which they were willing to come forward. Secondly, I want to talk about actually the view of that coalition, what's going on from the ground. Last week I was in Istanbul, met with about 15 military groups who came to see us from inside Syria. We're constantly doing this. We're constantly in touch with the folks on the ground, not just the military side, but those in Damascus, and those who would, I would say, have more pro-government and independently minded views as well. And thirdly, linked to that, is what prospect is there of some sort of a political process in Syria? Because at the end of the day, as Ken said, you can, you know, switch around the military side and the political side, but both of them matter. And certainly in the case of Syria, as we're learning in the case of Iraq, that's what we need. So first, in terms of the coalition, I think great credit to Secretary of State Kerry, as well as Secretary Hagel, as well as Susan Rice, and of course the President himself, in getting these five key Arab states to take a serious military activity on this. And, you know, it wasn't just political expediency. It wasn't just because there was a certain amount of pressure, because they themselves feel an existential threat. The Saudi border is not the most, in my view, most defensible. The Jordanians are facing infiltration. We look at what's going on in Lebanon. And then, of course, there's Turkey as an example, and Iraq, of course. But Turkey, you know, Turkey does face some very difficult choices, which we can talk about in the Q&A, not least facing its own terrorist threats, maybe in the medium to longer term as this thing goes on. So that was an achievement. And this whole strategy of trying to bring in Sunni communities on the ground, in the case of Iraq, as well as a political effort with the Sunnis, is an important playbook to follow, certainly in Iraq, but also in Syria itself. Because at the end of the day, it's really going to be those communities inside, those communities in Al Jazeera and Raqqa and Hasaka and Deir ez-Zor and elsewhere in Syria, which are going to be the ones that can marginalize and effectively make redundant Daesh, but also the ideology, which is much more difficult to wipe out. I should also point out, by the way, that probably something like 6,000-7,000 Syrian fighters have been killed in fighting against Daesh even before this coalition was reached. And in fact, early this year, many of them, these fighting groups, had actually succeeded in expelling Daesh, whether it was from the suburbs of Damascus or whether it was up in Idlib. So this is there's a clear desire for them to fight against Daesh and to see them as a threat that they are to their own society. That's the better news. Now, in terms of the not-so-good news, and here what we heard from these fighting groups pretty much across the board, they are very secular-minded, those who are being supported by the United States and the West, some have been vetting and all the rest of it, all the way to the spectrum of the more Islamist groups like Ar al-Sham or Jaid al-Sham and Jaish Islam and groups like that. Across the board, they said two, three things. One, there was no cooperation with us, no coordination with us as these airstrikes started. So how are we supposed to take advantage of these things? In fact, leader of Harak Hazm said to us, I read it in the newspaper. Secondly, and this is one of the groups that the US is supporting. Secondly, it won't wash with them that this is very much a strategy which is just focused on Daesh. They see that there should be a parallel effort, at least to put pressure, and if necessary, take the fight to Bashar al-Assad himself. And they particularly point to the aircraft that the Assad regime is flying every single day and using its barrel bombs and using all the other armory and armor that it's got. And they point out, at conservatively, if you look at the Syrian National Human Rights Body, in terms of their data, and I know those are conservative figures, in the month of September, 2,500 Syrians were killed. Now, most of those were killed by the regime, not by Daesh. And that's the reality that most Syrians are facing day in, day out. And what we were told, if this strategy continues and only focusing narrowly on the regime, effectively pursuing what they perceive as a narrow counterterrorism effort, which is very much in what they say in Western or U.S. interests, we're going to start losing our communities. And these people, whatever you may say about them, are very much part of their communities. I know they've been branded as farmers and dentists and lawyers and all the rest of it, but they took up arms, maybe some of them, a year and a half ago. They have been training themselves. Some of them have had training. And they see themselves very much, first and foremost, as protecting their communities and building the kind of civil infrastructure in a vacuum which has persisted all the time while the rest of the world has pretty much looked away. There's also the moral argument that we use when it comes to Daesh. We say Daesh, rightfully so, are these murderous barbarians doing horrible things, and of course we've seen that, unfortunately, in terms of the videos that they've produced, mass killings and all the rest of it. But they say you can't take the moral argument by just focusing on one group. What about the moral, ideological argument in terms of what the Assad regime is doing? And again, it undermines the effort to win hearts and minds, not just in those communities, but I would say more wider in the region and in, and I dare say, in the Islamic world, when there is, this is seen very much more as a narrow focus rather than, as in the words of one commander, as a battle between decency, values that we all hold, and barbarism. And the barbarism doesn't stop just with Daesh. So, again, in practical terms, I think this is going to continue to have a wearing effect in terms of the coalition's effort. And remember, if you go into social media, if you go and look at the Facebook entries of Saudis, of Qataris, of Emiratis, of Jordanians and others that are pointing all of this out. Because at the end of the day, even these leaderships will be affected by what they are hearing from within their own from within their own populations. And yet we need them very much to be an active part of this coalition. So my second point is that an open-ended, which is what it is right now, military strategy without a real political strategy is not going to work. This is where we need to have a parallel effort on the political side, which is focused on looking to see how you can change the dynamics within Syria. If Nouri al-Maliki and his ways were a problem in Iraq, well, certainly after maybe 200,000, 250,000 people killed in a civil conflict in Iraq, Bashar al-Assad and his regime certainly are as well. And this is, again, what we don't hear just from what people you would brand as opposition people. We also hear this from certain tiers, from even within the Alawi community. We hear this from within the Druze or Kurdish community. We hear this even from within the Christian communities, as well as business leaders, as well as tribal heads. The point I'm trying to make is that there is a broad, wide spectrum of opinion which understands that the cause of this is the fact that initially you had an uprising which increasingly grew bloody against Bashar al-Assad and his rule. And until you're not able to address that, you're going to find it hard work in order to be able to fill the vacuums which have now been filled by the extremists themselves. And here, let me say, in terms of the groups that we've spoken to, including the military groups, they very much point out that they want peace. They want a ceasefire. They're tired. They don't want this to continue. And we also hear something similar from even, let's say, third, fourth ranked Alawi security officers and other such elements that we've been able to speak to. The question, though, is how? And, of course, that's not an easy question to answer. How do you get a political process going in Syria which has the chance of turning this situation? I'd offer to you two things which have come from our own sort of workshops and study groups that we've been facilitating, as Mike kindly pointed out, over the last 9 months or so. First and foremost, they do talk about still a political agreement, but a political agreement that would put Assad to one side, but which crucially needs still the Iranians and Russians to seek a separate path. Now, most of you will think, well, that's pretty fantastic. Didn't we try that with Geneva in January, February? And by the way, it's made even more difficult because the Assad regime doesn't want anybody to talk. We've tried to bring people out from Damascus. We're speaking to other people, and they're extremely scared of talking because of the fact that the Assad regime really doesn't want anyone to talk right now. Don't take my word for it. Look at Walid Mualim, the Syrian foreign minister's speech even at the UN, where he said there's no political process that is possible right now. Yet, the Russians and the Iranians have been behind the scenes, I would say, in the last couple of months, been testing some ideas. I know that the Iranians have discussed ideas again about a national unity government of some sort. Now, many of you will be skeptical, and you should be. I'm skeptical. But nevertheless, there has been some quite serious conversations in that regard. The Russians, too, have been discussing about ideas of dialogue and national dialogue and how do you get a national dialogue process going in Syria. I think what we have to do, even if it's difficult, is try and prepare for that moment of what I would call in UN speak, we would talk about as of diplomatic ripeness, whereby which certain interests can converge. And certainly, since June, since Mosul, things have started to change on the ground, which is also having an impact in terms of the Iranian and Russian war effort in supporting Bashar al-Assad. That's just the reality that they're also living with. So we need an initial political agreement that would bring in some sort of a new unity government of some sort that tries to implement some of the original Annan 6 points of some sort of ceasefire and release of detainees, but also, and this is the point I wanted to make, sets us not from just that immediate but to the longer term in terms of a political process which inevitably is going to take some time, and that is a national dialogue process, a clause rather like we saw in the Yemen case where there was built into an agreement the idea of a national dialogue. And here we've been talking and working on the design for something like that, making, I think it was probably hundreds of Syrians from all different backgrounds discuss what should be the mandate, what should be the agenda, who should be invited, all the rest of it. And these are the kinds of important things I think that need to be worked on that will actually empower Syrians in a moment of change to work on a political process which can bring security, stability, which can set an agenda on the civil justice side as well as on the economic reconstruction side, as well as charting a new pathway, a new political pathway, to their new state, a new vision, especially through a constitution. And here is where the international community does have a particular role to play when that starts to get going. First and foremost, in making sure that it happens, if we were to put as much emphasis as we are on Daesh, on the security side, as we should be on starting a political process again, I think we may start to see some of those ideas not only being tested, but perhaps coming to fruition over a relatively short period of time. And that is the hope I would have. The final thing I would say to you, I know I pick up, there's quite a lot of talk, I think, in this town as well as in other places that I go to, about of Assad's staying. He's not going anywhere. And that this is just a reality that we have to live with and we have to put him to one side. That's actually not true. There's turmoil within the Alawi community, we know that. We can talk about that more. Secondly, on the battlefield, without their aircraft, they actually lose a lot of their battles. And thirdly, in terms of the ability of people wanting to talk, there's all sorts of contacts going on now between regime elements and local and national elements on the opposition side and those who consider themselves independents. Finally, those say, well, what if Assad goes? What are the alternatives? Well, all I would say to you is I'll tell you what the alternative is, that if Assad stays, and that is we're going to end up in a fairly short amount of time with a more intensified conflict, even more fragmented on the ground, which essentially becomes, in my view, a fight between Daesh and the regime, and that's not a very good choice that we should face.
Let me ask one clarifying question as well of you that's very, very good and very rich. And there's a lot more to talk about, we will. But whatever model for a new political governance of Syria might emerge from the process that you're describing, whether it's, confederation, whether it's a strong state, but some kind of a reconciliation process that allows people to get beyond their hatreds and paranoias and mistrust, whatever it might be, do you think that it is likely to require the deployment of a substantial international peacekeeping or peace implementation force of some kind? Recognizing it's way too soon to know, but just in terms of shaping our expectations, could you speak to that?
Sure. Short answer is possibly. But it has to be done through some sort of a dialogue and discussion with Syrians themselves, and particularly those elements on the ground. Now, that's difficult, which is why, again, we need to create the vehicles to engage, because unfortunately, and I'm sorry to say this, the official opposition, the Ittihad, just hasn't cut it as being their representatives. We need to be able to find those elements on the ground and encourage them to produce the kinds of structures as part of a broader political process, which then allows us to ask these questions. The role of the international community, if you ask Syrians from what we've been, is extremely complicated for people to answer. They want the international community to come in and protect their rights and to give them support. But at the same time, they're sick and tired of the interference of the international, of the regional states in particular, as well as the, and they're very much more suspicious of it as the conflict is now into its fourth year. And so I think that's the way to answer. I will say one more thing, which I forgot. The military groups on the ground right now are in their own process now, having given up to a certain degree in terms of externally led efforts, to form their own coalition or revolutionary command, which they called Wattissimo, which includes military groups right across the spectrum, those who are getting the support of the US and the West, and those in the Islamic Front, which is modeled on a covenant which was signed in June, July, with groups like Arar al-Sham and some of the more secular-leaning groups. And if this effort works, they will be forming a council which is part political, part civil, part military. I'll tell you what, the thing that they're most worried about is outside interference, because some of those groups are starting to get that, including from some of their Gulf patrons, which I think would be a very bad thing, because we should see the results of this. We should see the platform on which they base themselves. If they're able to succeed, that then gives a basis, in my view, to work with folks on the ground in those areas, knowing that we have to bring in people on the more pro-government or independent side, as well as the Ittihad, which, in my view, could serve as a foreign ministry for something like that.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And now what I'd like to do as we move towards conversation with you is really just pose one more question, and it's to Ken, and it's his take on Syria. So with just a couple of minutes before I can invite your comments and questions, what I'd like to do is ask Ken to speak about Syria. He's got a very helpful and in many ways provocative paper that you might have seen on the table out front, building and expanding on a foreign affairs article he recently wrote. It's a country he's thought a lot about as well. I just wanted to ask you to offer your thoughts on appropriate next steps in Syria, and then we can go to a broader discussion.
Thanks, Mike. And yes, I'll be quick, because most of what I want to say is kind of echoing and picking up on themes that Salman's already laid out. But I just want to make a few points about Syria. First, someone is absolutely right that this has got to be about more than just the fight against Daesh. And that means a lot more in Syria than it does in Iraq. In Iraq, we're actually doing some of the stuff that is necessary to deal with the underlying problems that enabled the Daesh offensive, that gave rise to the new civil war in Iraq. In Syria, I think that we're going to do that. I hope that we are. At least what, say, Chairman Dempsey has talked about suggests that we will, and the paper that Mike talked about that's out front outlines exactly what would be necessary. But I don't yet see the U.S. government signed up for that yet. Okay, and that comes up in a few different ways, and I think that they are important. The first is how the president is describing this. Okay? We're going to degrade and destroy ISIL. That's fine. That's like talking to a person with Ebola and saying we're going to get your fever down. That's important, right? We all want to do that. It does not deal with the underlying problem, and we need to recognize that. Daesh is not the problem. Daesh is the symptom of the problem. The problem is the civil war in Syria and Iraq, and for that matter, Libya and Yemen and potentially Lebanon as well. Right? Those are the underlying problems. Again, in Iraq, the administration, with a little bit of sleight of hand, is actually doing just that. And that represents those important political steps I talked about beforehand. I do not yet see them ready to even acknowledge that they're going to need to do that in Syria. And that includes Salman's very important point about this has to be about the regime as well. Right? It can't just be about trying to crush Daesh in Syria. It won't work. Even if we somehow did that, if we did not deal with the underlying civil war there, a year from now there'd be another group, maybe calling itself Daesh, maybe calling itself something completely different. It'd be the same problem because these civil wars generate exactly this problem. We've been seeing that now in the region at least since 9/11, but arguably even before then. And it's a constant out there. Excuse me. Second piece of it, also something that Salman was related to, we need to recognize that we are now building a Syrian opposition army. Right? Again, that's what General Dempsey has testified. We're going to train 5,000 guys. That'll be the start of probably 10 or 15,000 in a couple of years' time. Those guys intend to fight Assad. And good luck to us if we think that we're going to stop them once they are trained and armed, right? So we're in this. And while I understand why the administration may not want to declare the fight on Assad just yet for a whole variety of political reasons, they're going to need to do so. And by the way, all of those allies who signed up, as someone pointed out, they're signed up for the fight against Assad, even more than they are signed up for the fight against Daesh. Last point. The last piece that's missing, the biggest piece that's missing, and to me, the thing that I'm most concerned about right now is the lack of any conversation about the political, economic, and social reconstruction of Syria that is going to need to take place as part of this process. Not after, as part of it. This was the lesson that the Bush administration screwed up so horrendously in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Right? This is a mistake that President Obama himself recognized he made with Libya when he told Tom Friedman of the New York Times that he recognized that just trying to do the military takedown in Libya was a mistake. There had to have been this political, economic, social follow-through, which I will, for lack of a better term, call nation-building. Right? Syria is going to need it too. We can't just walk in there, crush Daesh, and walk away. We are going to have to help the Syrians and others build a stable Syrian society. And if we do it right, it means starting right now, and it means enlisting all kinds of other groups so that we don't have to try to do it the way that we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, which not only didn't work, but also was ruinously expensive. If we do it right in Syria, there's every reason to believe the UN can provide the leadership. The NGOs can provide most of the muscle work. We'll probably provide at least a good chunk of the security, and the Gulf states will provide most of the money. But we can't get away from that. The president was right when he said to Tom Friedman that you can't simply do the military piece and walk away. You've got to do the nation-building piece of it. And again, the worst mistake we could make would be to try not to do it, because if that's the case, we will solve nothing, or else we will then try to make things up as we go along after the fact, the way the Bush administration did, and it will be ruinously expensive. If we do it now, there is no reason it needs to be like Iraq or Afghanistan. There is every reason to believe that it can be an international effort led mostly by Syrians with a long-term bottom-up process that produces a stable outcome which we don't have to pay for. The worst mistake that we can make is to keep trying to duck this problem. And I recognize this is not a very popular thing to say, but if there is anything that the history of the last 13 years should have told us, it is the necessity of that.
Thank you. So now I'm going to take three questions at a time, and if you like, you could direct them to one person. And then what we'll do is we'll probably just cycle through and each use the podium in replying. So start over here with Dan, then we'll go back to the middle and then to the side for the first round. Yes, here you go.
Daniel Serwer from Johns Hopkins SAIS. Can you provoke me to say, first of all, that I agree with you 100% on the state-building aspect. I call it state-building rather than nation-building for good reasons. The question is, what kind of strategy we're going to pursue. And I think right now there are two choices. One is to consider state building as something that we can only do once Bashar al-Assad is gone, and all we can do right now is plan for it. The other is to consider what, in fact, we did in Bosnia and other places, which is to start building, rebuilding the Syrian state from local situations. And I wonder if you could comment on the choice between those approaches or others that you may have.
Thank you. Here in the center.
Pierre Ghanem from Al Arabiya. The president is meeting this afternoon at the Pentagon with the leaders of the DOD and the military. If you were to tell him what is the next decision, what kind of a decision you would like him to take today?
Okay, and then the third question will be over here, and then we'll answer, and then we'll do a second round.
Hi, my name is Nick Boros with TD International. Kind of an open-ended question. How would you describe Iran's involvement in both countries, so it's for both panelists, and what role could Iran play in the state-building or nation-building process?
Thank you for three excellent questions. I'm going to start, but I'm going to be fairly brief, and it's going to be mostly on the second question, and then we'll just invite, we'll work down the row here, and everybody can comment on whichever questions they wish. There's really only one set of thoughts I would make, but your question sets me up to make the point that I was hoping to make today, which is basically how we can be effective inside of Iraq in the short to medium term. And I think the Syria problem is harder. I agree with Ken, the Iraq part is the relatively more manageable and better news in a sense. But I do think that even in Iraq, we don't quite have it right yet. And the reason is because we're still maintaining these artificial firewalls, no boots on the ground, and no American combat, even though we've obviously violated both of those stipulations already that are supposed to be constraining our effort. We have 1,700 people on the ground in uniform in Iraq, and we're dropping bombs all the time from the sky. So we have boots on the ground, and we're in combat. I understand the main point here is to say we don't want to do any large-scale invasion again, but there still is an intermediate zone of two types of operations that I believe we need to seriously consider. And one would be advisory teams for the Iraqi army units and National Guard units that are now being either reconstituted or built from scratch in the coming weeks and months. The Iraqis will do the building, the Iraqis will do the fighting, but I think they're going to need some help in making this all stitch together. And the other is I would be willing and see a case for American Special Forces being involved in collaboration with Iraqi Special Forces in the early weeks of any major counteroffensive against ISIL to actually join in some of the raids. And not to do it permanently, not to take the main role, but to help. Because that early period can be a period we go on the offensive very effectively with the Iraqis and build a momentum in the way that Stan McChrystal and Bill McRaven showed us we could do by an intensity and a pace of special forces raids that can really create a synergistic effect. Just one last point of explanation before I pass off to Ken. When you ask, well, you know, why this would be needed, especially the military advisory teams in the field, part of it is helping the Iraqis themselves regain their own confidence with each other, working together in some mechanisms and some modes that haven't yet even been decided upon, as Ken pointed out. But even once they decide what the role is of the National Guard versus the Army and so forth, you're going to have to get people working together who right now often don't talk to each other, fundamentally distrust each other. Americans actually have some of the personal relationships that can stitch some of these individuals and pieces of the whole problem together because of the human dimension of our relationships built up over the last decade. But on top of that, let me also just remind you all, and many people in this room, and certainly Mark Kimmett and a few others know extremely well, better than I, what I'm going to say. But when you actually do these sorts of operations, it is difficult. People have an image of counterinsurgency or of the surge in Iraq as just being pumping more troops into more neighborhoods, and then the problem sort of gets taken care of by brute force. But in fact, if you know the military history, read the military history of what we did in these places, there is a complex sequencing that involves with first developing an intelligence picture of the battlefield by talking to your human intelligence sources, listening through signals intelligence, but that's not going to be good enough. So then you got to use that as your first draft, and you go in and you do raids of various types, and you try to arrest, not kill people, and interrogate them, and find out more about where the leadership nodes are, where the weapons caches are, where the rat lines for supply, for movement of people are. And that helps you then build up a better picture. And then after you do all that, you have to figure out what kind of a clearing operation are you going to conduct in a given neighborhood or sector of a city. You've got to have enough troops to do that. You've got to initially bring in some people who can clear roadside bombs, so you take as few casualties as possible doing that. You've got to cordon off the area that you're trying to clear so that the enemy can't easily escape. You've got to have then some rapid response teams in case the enemy is stronger there than you expected, and also you've got to be able to have a holding force come in afterwards, be it this National Guard or some other unit. I'm not claiming to do this all with perfect precision and sophistication and how I've laid out the 101 of how you do counterinsurgency and clearing, but it's something like what I just said. It may vary from case to case, but it's something like that. It's hard. It's not necessarily brain surgery, but it's complicated, especially in the logistics and the pacing and the coordination. And I question whether Iraqi units that are going to be fashioned out of a few tribal fighters here and a few formerly disgruntled soldiers there will quickly have the capacity. We can't do it for them, but I think we can help them as coaches, as advisors. So that's why I think we need these advisory teams in the field. It'll make the whole job a lot easier if we're willing to contemplate that. And I'm talking about at most a few thousand people. So certainly more than the 1,700 we've got now, but certainly well less than even a single division, and certainly nothing close to the forces we had during the 2003 to 2011 period. I'll pass things off now to my colleagues.
You want me to do it here?
As you wish.
It's okay to do it here? You can hear me? Yeah. Okay. Camera guy.
TV.
First of all, I know it's directed to Ken in terms of state building or nation building, but let me suggest a sort of a practical way forward in this regard. In our own discussions on national dialogue efforts, folks have identified three areas that they would like to focus on. How do you build long-term security, including the combat against extremism, but also the reform of institutions, border control, weapons proliferation, how to deal with that, as well as reintegration of fighters and things like that. Secondly, is a sort of civil economic agenda. How do you achieve justice? How do you deal with the suffering and hurt that has been caused? How do you deal with issues of even compensation, expropriation of property? How do you deal with the whole area of economic reconstruction and development? And thirdly is, as I told you before, what's the political pathway to a new constitution? Now, in all of these areas, and I can go into much more detail, but I know we don't have time, there is a series of things here that the international community, if it was organized and if it was so minded, could very much help on as a Syrian-led national dialogue starts to try and resolve these kinds of questions that they pose under these kinds of themes. And I think to make it even more structured, I would suggest some sort of an international steering group. The UN has set up many international steering groups, some of that have worked, some that haven't, that are very much bring in, let's say, the coalition partners that we have right now, but hold out also the possibility of the Russians or the Iranians and others being part of it, very much task-based to support particular activities or a particular set of goals in that state-building effort. And, of course, they're going to have to be committed for the long term because this is not something that's going to end, even in the initial phases. It's not going to end for another 10, 15 years. So you need that kind of commitment, as well as the multinational and multilateral organizations that that need to be involved. That's what I would say. And that, of course, does include the local elements organizing themselves, whether it's currently the interim government or whether it's other formations, the civil administrations that have set up around the major towns and regions as being part of that. And what's been a fascinating discussion is how do you select who's part of this political process? And again, this is part of the preparatory work that needs to be done if you're to raise this kind of process. And it's absolutely necessary. If you look at Yemen, Afghanistan, you look at the 90s in terms of the West Africa national dialogue efforts, there's so many that have adopted different ways in which to bring the right people to the table, but you need the right people at the table. In terms of the military, I would just say to President Obama, I would say you need to be looking at a no-fly zone, or at least threaten to impose one. If the Assad regime's aircraft continue 10 seconds away from an American F-16 or another in another area, are still bombing. And there have, and commanders on the ground have pointed out to us specific instances where there are coalition aircraft in the north, and in the south, the regime is doing a bombing run or flying a helicopter, barrel bombing, and that kind of thing. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of buffer zones. We all speculated on this pretty much when this crisis became militarized, about neighboring states establishing de facto borders if they could. Well, that's what's happening. I have a fair degree of confidence. I think in the end the Turks will establish something themselves. You have a de facto buffer zone along the Israeli border, incidentally, I think, manned by Jabhat al-Nusra and by Jordan, and a buffer zone on the border with Jordan as well. And that's mainly for self-interest in terms of the control of refugees, what kind of bad elements are coming across. But these can also serve as the kind of safe havens which are needed in order to be able to protect civilians. And let me just say finally, and I'll leave the Iran bit to Ken, since other than what I've already said, is that many people make this point to us that fighting Daesh and protecting civilians are two sides of the same coin. You can't say that you're fighting terrorism, but have civilians being killed in this way with the responsibility to protect them completely forgotten, first and foremost in terms of the regimes and the authorities themselves, but then also in terms of the international community's role. And therefore, we now do have to look at practical ways where we can stop civilians being killed in this way.
Dan, if you prefer state building to nation building, sign me up. I'm good with that, especially given how people feel about the term nation building. We probably do need to find a different one. You posed it as a question, but I'm going to assume by implication that you think that the smarter move is your second path, and I'm simply going to say I think that is the right way to go. The lesson that I learned, first, before we ever went into Iraq, just talking to people who had worked on Bosnia, had worked on Kosovo, Cambodia, Haiti, Timor, all these different places, was that these processes work best when they work from the bottom up. And I think that Iraq and Afghanistan, because we didn't bother to do that, have proved that once again, that trying from the top down is much more problematic. Now, there obviously has to be a top-down component to it, right? You can't just walk in and do nothing at that top level. And in particular, you're going to need a constitutional process, and you're going to need folks advising, even if the UN is in charge, as I think that they ought to be, you're going to need folks at that level as well. But in an ideal world, you really want to allow the leadership to grow from the bottom up. And I think that you're absolutely right. It needs to start right away from the moment that we cross the border. And, in fact, we need to be planning for it, preparing for it even before these forces cross the border, which is my response to Mr. Khanom's question about what's my one thing I'd say to the president. It's that. It's, Mr. President, you're going to have to do state building in Syria. The problem is well beyond Daesh, and it has to start now. As any number of people reminded us very rightly before the invasion of Iraq, the U.S. started planning for the reconstruction of Germany and Japan in 1942, right? And it wasn't a day too soon. And there's a lot of work that needs to go into it, and it is a terrible mistake to try to make it up after we've already started to do that. And then last, the question about Iran. As always, because it's Iran, it's complicated. And let me try to be a little bit brief, though. It differs in both places. In Iraq, the Iranians obviously have a very important role to play. Right now, like it or not, many Shia don't like it, but they are the great power backer of the Shia. They've got advisors all over the place. There are a lot of different questions I could have raised in my prepared remarks. Another one I was thinking of but chose not to, but I'll raise it now, is I want to know how the American advisors to the Iraqi units are going to interact with the Iranian advisors to those same units. That's going to be a really interesting dynamic. We'll have to figure that out. But the Iranians are there. They have a very important role to play. I think that both there, and now I'm kind of transitioning a little bit over to Syria, what we learned from Iraq is that a strong Iraqi political process takes care of the Iranian political influence. It marginalizes it, and it marginalizes it better than we ever could. And I think that it would be a mistake for us to worry obsessively about Iranian influence in Iraq. The smart move is to try to rebuild a strong, functional Iraqi state. That's what we need to deal with the problems of Iraq, to deal with the problems of Daesh, and ultimately that is the right answer to the, whatever our concerns are about Iran. The Iraqis will keep the Iranians at bay much more effectively than we ever will. Syria, I'd say it's a matter of sequencing. Right now, again, the Iranians, along with the Russians, are the great power backers of the regime. And if we're going to have a negotiated settlement, which, again, I think does start with a major shift on the battlefield, but you don't want to simply empower the Sunnis to slaughter all of the Alawi. That's not a good outcome to this either. And I think that that's why the point that Salman has been at pains to make both today and in a whole variety of other instances, that there are Alawis who are looking to reconcile, who would be willing to get rid of Assad. And I think that's what it's ultimately going to come down to, is to convince the Iranians that Assad is finished, that militarily this is not going to result in his victory. And then it becomes a moment when I think the Iranians have every incentive to cooperate in forging a new power-sharing arrangement, very much along the lines of what happened with the Russians in Bosnia. If you remember, the Russians were dead set against the Dayton Accords or something like it up until the moment that the NATO bombing campaign, but really the Croats and Bosniaks on the ground, were beating the stuffing out of the Serbs. And it became clear that the Serbs were going to lose. And then all of a sudden, the Russians not only were in favor of it, they wanted to be part of the peacekeeping force to make sure that they had their say and the Serbs got their say. And I think you can imagine a kind of analogous situation with Iran in Syria, whereby if the Iranians become convinced that Assad is not going to win this fight, he is going to lose, they then have every incentive to back the Alawis in cutting loose Assad and cutting a deal soon before they do get crushed. And that's how you get to kind of a Dayton-like solution for Syria. And again, once that happens, then I think that it becomes up to the Syrians to decide what kind of a relationship they want to have with Iran. Again, I think that if we build a strong, stable, pluralist Syrian state, they're going to determine their own relationship with the Iranians, and my guess is that Iran will not be a dominant power in Syria. But I think that's, again, how we need to think about it. And again, the common thread that runs between them is, again, we've got to build strong, stable states in both places. We need that for our own reasons, for their reasons. And one of the side benefits is that will help to diminish Iran's influence in both countries.
Great. So we'll go to another round now. And glad to have a number of hands. I've seen these three for a couple of minutes, so I'll take them. And then we'll move in the following round out here. But Gary... yeah, exactly. Gary, and then here in the center, and then over on the side. Please.
Thanks very much. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And I want to, Mike, I want to sort of pose two questions that I would appreciate the group addressing that really haven't been talked about today, but which are out there in the land, and I'm talking about in the U.S., and probably not anybody in this room, but there are questions that come up all the time, and I would appreciate hearing the best answers to those. One is, we're pretty sure, this is a statement, this is intended to be the question, we're pretty sure that when we engage in kinetic actions these days in that part of the world, we're creating more jihadis militarily. And what's worse is the geography from which these people are coming is broader and getting closer to home. Second, Ken has said that he didn't say ISIL, but I'll say ISIL because I know isn't the problem. ISIL is the symptom. The problem is this proliferation of civil wars, if I have that right. If that's the case, why are we in this, and isn't it over the long haul about time for us writ large to understand that these are deep-seated problems that are centuries old, that have been complicated by recent history, and that there may come a time at which we collectively, the royal, we need to get out and let these people deal with it themselves.
There's only one thing I know that you don't know, Gary, which is how many hands were up behind you. And therefore, I'm going to, these were big questions. I'm going to ask for short answers. And I'm going to, so with apologies that they won't be complete answers to these grand sweeps of history, but they're very good questions. Here in the middle.
Thank you. I'm Marius Oswald with the German Embassy. So one of the things that we discussed a lot over the last few days, especially, is Turkey's involvement and potential role. And I know that General Allen also is expected, I think, tomorrow in Ankara. I'd really like to hear your thoughts about what difference can Turkey make on the ground, especially in the border region, of course. What holds them back, and how can they be encouraged to get more involved? Thanks.
And finally, over here, this gentleman.
Sir, I'm Colonel Sajjad from Bangladesh. I have been engaging and teaching with madrasas and Islamic schools for the last 7 years. What we are talking about, IS, is not such a big experience or such a popular concept in those madrasas in almost every Muslim country. What they are talking about, something bigger, is called Khilafat. Now, Khilafat is a much easier word and a much more peaceful world. But if you remember, when the IS started, they made a Khalifa. That's the Khilafat I'm talking about. By the name of Khilafat, teams are going around to madrasas and to many Muslim institutes all over the world, recruiting people and telling them that there are secret sanctuaries, safe sanctuaries, you'll be trained, you'll be getting a lot of money, and you'll inshallah go to heaven if you become a martyr, and this is working. Is the international community aware of it and taking some steps about it? That's very important. Number two, sir, Bangladesh has shed too much blood in peacekeeping force. We are the largest peacekeeping force in the world, and I work on that. If you have to have peacekeeping in Syria, you can't have the same forces, same equipment that you're using in Ivory Coast or in Sierra Leone or in Bosnia. There has to be special forces under UN. Preparation should go from now. Selection should go on from now. And it must be prepared from now. These are my two small suggestions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I'm going to pass myself on responding to any of these. So Ken or Salman, who would like to start?
You want to start?
Sure, I'll start since you started last time.
Yeah, why not, I guess.
All right, so I'm going to leave the hard questions to Salman and just take Gary's easy one and try to be quick about it. Gary, as you know, as well as anybody in this audience, maybe better, you know, one of the things that we try to do at Brookings is we try to take the tools of scholarship and the knowledge of the scholars and apply them to policy questions. And civil wars is one of these areas where we actually have a phenomenal body of scholarship. I mean, there's a group of people have been working on civil wars for 30, 40 years and have just done tremendous work on the subject. And what's really striking is that while it is the common impression that these civil wars are born of these centuries-old problems and you know, they're ancient hatreds, that's actually not the case at all. Okay? They are born of state failure. And when there is state failure, groups reach for primordial identities. And the primordial identities don't matter. In every state, they're different, but in every state, they exist. And people go reaching for them, and it's all a product of state failure and the creation of a security vacuum. And so ultimately, dealing with problems of civil wars is ultimately about dealing with that. And again, there's this great body of literature out there. I think that it's still nevertheless a fair question to ask, well, why is it that we keep getting involved? in all of this stuff, right? And why is it happening again and again in the Middle East? And why is it happening again and again in the Middle East? My answer to that, and at some point I'm going to write this, is that what we're seeing in the Middle East and have seen over the last 20, 30 years is the failure of the post-war Arab state system, or Muslim Middle Eastern state system. That after World War II, after decolonization, you had the appearance of a group of states and a state system, a regional order overseen by the United States, that has increasingly been under pressure over the last 20 years. Okay? And this is what gave rise to the Arab Spring. And much of what we're seeing, these civil wars, is a product of the Arab Spring, coupled with the United States going in and breaking a few regimes and then not putting anything in its place. But it's this consistent pattern of state failure. That's why what's going on in Libya and Syria and Yemen looks so much like what's going on in Iraq and what was going on in Lebanon and what's going on in Afghanistan. That's ultimately what this is all about. And, you know, my feeling is that many of these civil wars, all of these civil wars are a tragedy. Many of these civil wars, though, are not necessarily a threat to American interests, but some of them are. And unfortunately, the Iraqi civil war is one of them. And as I think you know, others probably do as well, my feeling about Syria was I was very nervous about Syria right from the get-go because of my fear of spillover. Because of my fear, and one of the problems that you see with these civil wars is that these civil wars spread. Civil war in one country can cause civil war in another. And given that you had a bunch of weak states around Syria, I was very fearful that it would cause civil wars in other countries. But my feeling was, look, until that happens, spillover is nothing but a possibility, a potential out there. It's reasonable for the United States to say we're not going to get involved. We will try containing it, which is a very difficult thing to do. Well, my feeling is on June 10th, that policy failed. And spillover from Syria reignited the civil war in Iraq, which unfortunately does affect U.S. interests because of the oil. Right, let's put that on the table. Let's not shy away from it. Because of our dependence, because of the global economy's dependence on stable oil prices. Right, and so, you know, I come to the Syria problem somewhat reluctantly. But my feeling is we are now in it. President Obama was even more reluctant than I was, and he's now in it. Being in it, we have no alternative but to handle it properly. And the right way to handle it is to address it as the problem of a civil war that needs to get handled as such. And again, the nice thing is we do have a very nice body of work from the scholars, from the policy community as well, which Dan can attest to, of how you go about doing these things. It's not impossible. It is difficult, and it isn't necessarily cheap, which again is why I'd like to see other people paying for this one. And I would just agree that, yes, we've got to do this now, and having others participating, a wonderful thing, but it needs to start now.
The problem coming up here is that we want to keep talking, but I'll try and be brief myself. First of all, on the Khalifat thing, I mean, it's clear to say, first and foremost, that 99% of, I would say 98% of Muslims don't follow Mr. Baghdadi or feel that there is this new state born. Sure, and I as a Muslim very much am like so many other Muslims who don't take his pronouncements and the establishment of this state very seriously. And we have to say that very clearly. And also, the methods that they've employed are completely anathema to everything that the teachings of Islam, I believe, have been taught, have been said. So we have to say that first and foremost. Having said that, it is this issue of state failure, the lack of dignity, lack of prospects, the political breakdown in societies, the inability to share power, which has given rise to this kind of ideology. And by the way, and which is also being fermented by certain elements, Muslim elements that are sitting in the West, very small, but nevertheless. And that is why I'm worried about aspects of Pakistan. That's why I'm worried about other aspects, whether it's in Bangladesh or whether it is elsewhere in India, as well as Central Asia, etc. And I think it's this prospect of having leaderships that are focused on their own populations and building up their states and getting beyond that post-independence failures that they've all been living through, which is so important. And here, let me turn it to the other question, Syria. I actually, maybe you think I'm crazy, but I actually think Syria is a potentially a very important catalyst to show what is possible in these societies. Syrians, first and foremost, by their nature, are not sectarian. They are Syrians first, and you hear that even today. When you listen and you hear them, they speak very much as Syrians first, despite the differences of geography that they may have, or in terms of sect and all the rest of it. And that, it's in itself, is a very heartening thing to hear. But then the question is, how can we empower these majority elements, not those on the extremes, whether it's the Assad regime or whether it is Daesh and those on the other side who do want to see this as a sectarian fight? Because in the middle, they're building schools for each other still. In East Ghouta, there are armed groups that are working with Christian doctors who are building who built a hospital. There are many such incidences through this conflict where you have that kind of cross community, or where they are protecting each other. But it goes back to what kind of political process can harness the kind of pluralism that is Syrian society and turn it into a workable power-sharing formula. And that, I actually think, is why Syria does matter. It also matters because, of course, state failure in Syria acts as a catalyst for the kind of spillover that we've seen, which, of course, is something that we have to avoid at all costs. On the Turkish question, very quickly. Well, there are two problems, of course, that the Turks have raised. One is the question of Assad. They want to see a clear pathway, as does King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia when he sat down with Barack Obama and others. They want to see a pathway whereby which Assad leaves, and that's why they are suggesting these kinds of ideas on no-fly zones and safe zones and other such things. The other, of course, is the added complication of the Kurdish question, and particularly the role of the PKK, the PYG, the Syrian arm, which initially grew strong because the Assad regime chose not to fight against them, but to let them grow. And this, of course, poses a big problem. What the Turks are essentially doing now, in my view, is negotiating the best deal with the US and with the Western powers. And it's a game of brinkmanship, because there are real lives at stake here, as we see in Kobani. One only hopes that we can come to a quick agreement and understanding on the way forward, because we do need Turkey as an active part of this coalition.
Thank you. We're going to do the final round. It's going to be a lightning round. Lightning for you, lightning for us. We promise to try to keep our part. I'm sure you'll do a better job than we. But nonetheless, one question per person, please. And I'm going to take four. And then we're going to wrap up within 8 minutes from now. This young woman here in the fourth row, I think. And then I want to make sure I get off to the sides a little bit as well. So we'll go to the back over there, work our way up over here, and then finally this gentleman here. So I could do that. You're going to have to take notes. Right here. So it'll be five, believe it or not. So the onus is on us to keep our questions straight. Please, ma'am.
I'll be quick. Tara Siegel, Georgetown University. I appreciated hearing about Syrian responses to the airstrikes and regional responses to the airstrikes. Before the airstrikes, the U.S. had supported police and local governance efforts on the ground in Syria. I'm wondering what Syrian responses have been to these, if they've been effective, and if that could be the first step towards state building.
Thank you. Back over here, please.
Hi, Martha Maratza from Crisis Action. In your opinion, what are the main blockages preventing the U.S. from more seriously pursuing a political solution in Syria? And how can civil society groups both here and in the region support and unblock those blockages?
My name is Winthrop Rogers. I was glad to hear about the Kurds just now, because they weren't mentioned much before. But how can we ignore the only secular effective force on the ground? Obviously, it's complicated by the PKK and NATO. But how can the U.S. approach this?
Alan Gieswetter with the Middle East Institute, and I think this is a question for Ken. It's hard to believe that the administration and President Obama does not have a Syrian political strategy, particularly after the interview with Friedman in which he said, I always ask now, the day after. So, what is it? There must be one. And if not, why not? And what's the explanation?
Okay, and finally here, second row, please.
Thanks. Lual Khatib from Brookings Doha Center. My question is to Ken. Now, with all these strategies that we have, are we just ignoring the fact that Iraq is already divided into three? Are we just delaying delaying the that divorce movement between the three parts? I'm asking this question because many analysts talk about what's happening today from the 10th of June. From the 10th of June, that Sunni-dominated zone became a no-go zone to the army, but it was a deadly zone to the rest of Iraqis, specifically Shia and Kurds. At the 2003 regime change was never acknowledged at a national level, and it was ignored at a regional level. Yes, we have embassies, but the sentiment in these countries did not comply with that regime change. Now, we really need to be candid about this. Are we just delaying that divorce movement? The Kurds, the fact that the Kurds want to be part of Iraq is for one simple reason. They want 17% plus from oil that happened to be in the south of Iraq, in Basra. And the Sunni would only recognize the rest of Iraqis as Iraqis if they get their fair share from oil in Basra. There is no national identity. That was not from the 2003, not from the 10th of June 2014. It was from 1920. We experienced 10 successful coup d'etats, half a century of dictatorship, and so on and so forth. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. 2 minutes each for my good friends, and then we'll be done.
You can take three. I'll take one.
I'm only going to pick up two different questions, Alan and Luas. Does work in some others as well. Alan, I continue to hear from other folks on the inside that there is no plan in place, and they're concerned about it as well, which is one of the reasons why I am trying to use my voice to call attention to this. Why is this the case? It strikes me that there may be, and this in some ways is also an answer to the young woman's question before, this may be a bureaucratic or a political issue, it might be a bureaucratic issue, might be a political issue. The bureaucratic issue may be that they just haven't gotten around to it yet, right? President's been busy. Yeah, they've had to put in place a military strategy. They've been flying airstrikes. He's been giving speeches. He's had to deal with Ebola. He's had to deal with a whole bunch of other things as well. The government may just be focused on this at the moment, and perhaps they just haven't quite gotten yet to. And by the way, they're also trying to build a big international coalition, and it may just be that they haven't quite gotten to this. And you've served in government for many years. You know the capacity of government is inherently limited. And it may be that in the bowels of the Pentagon, there are a bunch of people who are starting to think about this, because that's what they do, but it hasn't gotten to the interagency level yet, right? And it may not have gotten to the president's level yet. So that's one possibility. But what I'm concerned about is the political answer to that question, which is that the president hasn't yet crossed that Rubicon, and he's not yet ready to make that commitment. On this, he's behind American public opinion, which I think has been far more supportive of the strategy than I think he anticipated. And I've been looking at the polls very, very carefully, in addition to all the anecdotal information that the polling sites produce, which suggests actually fairly, quite strong support for everything that he's done so far, for the air campaign, for the training of the Syrian troops, for the training in Iraq, all this stuff. Very, very strong support. The only issue where there still is a fair degree of negativity is on the commitment of ground combat forces, although even that is changing over the course of time. So that's kind of an interesting thing. But, I worry that this is simply a matter of Barack Obama, the president who believes he was elected to get us out of wars in the Middle East, not wanting to recognize that, okay, he's done it, right? As I keep saying, we are committed to Syria, and we either are going to do it right or we're going to do it half-assed. We're not going to not do it at this point in time. And so my hope is that he goes ahead and does it. And, Louie, to your question about Iraq, You know, my feeling all along has been that since June 10th, the likelihood that we will go back to the old Iraq is gone. Right? I don't know what the new Iraq looks like, though. I suspect that the Kurds will at some point go their own separate way. When that will be, I can't tell you, but I still think there's a high risk of that happening within the next 10 or 12 months. But you're absolutely right that the money is a very strong incentive to remain at least nominally a part of Iraq for some period of time, and we'll have to see how they work things out. In my mind, though, the more complicated question is the Arab part of Iraq, the four-fifths of Iraq, because as you know well, most Iraqi Arabs consider themselves to be Iraqis and all part of the same community. They're not looking necessarily to split, but the problem is that the problems of the last 10 years have become so big, it's going to be very hard to get these pieces of the puzzle back together. And again, that's part of the challenge that I see moving forward in Iraq.
Okay, I actually want to address the same question in terms of political solution and then the Kurds as well. I actually think that, I mean, of course they're thinking about it, and I guess I've been privy to some of the discussions. The simple fact is that there have not been any great easy answers, especially after the sort of post-Geneva period. There's been a great hangover. What do we do? We can't bring this opposition groups with a regime that doesn't want to talk. You know, we can't continue to go through that kind of head-banging exercise. So what do we do? And I know Secretary Kerry has been very much focused on that. And I think also the relative malaise of the opposition itself has not helped gel more ideas. And then, of course, and I alluded to this right at the start, there is this dangerous notion that somehow Assad is here to stay, at least for now. So let's leave him to one side. Let's not focus on that aspect. And therefore, let's not really focus on the political aspects of what needs to be done, at least for now. I think that's all wrong. What really needs to take place, and I think it is happening actually, is a sort of a re-education exercise about how do we approach this. And part of that re-education exercise, and now what's become much more acceptable, is the thinking that we have to think much more broader in the types of Syrians that we want to involve in any kind of political process. You hear that over and over again now. I like to think it's partly to do with some of our work, but I think it's others' work too, in trying to bring to bear the various constituencies that are out there, both inside Syria and outside, as well as the regional players who would actually support a political process which involves a much more broader array of influential, important, nationalistic and other Syrians. But that does require U.S. leadership, as well as the United Nations. We have my friend Stefan de Mistura now, you know, who's a good man, who's got lots of experience looking at for political entry points to a new process, and he'll certainly be probing those. There needs now to be, as I said from the start, a renewed effort in that regard, and a renewed effort to eyeball the Russians and the Iranians as well and continue to test what is their willingness to really explore very serious ideas, where the reality still will remain that the Assad regime doesn't want to talk politics. It still thinks somehow it can ride this out and get the West on its side in the fight against Daesh. And then just on the Kurdish question, yes, of course, and of course we must recognize, especially with what's going on in Kobani again, the real stress and suffering that the Syrian Kurds are going through. Part of it is, I guess, resolved and helped by the involvement of Kurds from around the region, and the KRG in particular has a role to play in that regard. It's more controversial, the PKK and Syrian Kurds. But I would also stress something that I've stressed for a very long time, is a vital need for a Syrian-Arab dialogue, which can be in Syria and which can act as a catalyst for much broader dialogue across the region, which is absolutely needed. And in this case, again, we've got good material because you've got Arab tribes and Syrian Kurdish who've lived together as cousins for hundreds of years in the same space and pretty much still want the same things, even if sometimes they have been in conflict. I know this because, again, we've been running lots of workshops with them where they probably understand each other better than anyone else. And that, of course, then has to translate into practical action, We've already seen some of that in terms of FSA groups teaming up with Kurdish fighting groups on the ground to fight against Daesh. But we need to, again, find a way of encouraging that rather than just thinking of them as a separate entity.
In closing, I don't know that your question got full attention, so let me, without trying to do it justice or keep folks longer, I would simply say the following. Not knowing what's happening in Syria and the specific places where we drop bombs, I would just draw analogies with my understanding of the Iraq and Afghanistan and other experiences, and the bottom line is it all depends what comes next. You might or might not make people angry if you accidentally drop a bomb in not exactly where you were where you were trying to, or even if you took out 10 bad guys but 3 good guys, you can create some pretty mixed feelings. So the whole question is, what comes next? Is there a strategy that allows people who want to work with you to stay alive and have some hope of opposing your common enemy, or are you trying to do this all from such a distance that there's no prospect of really shaping? And the reason I say this, basically, is if you look in places in Iraq and Afghanistan where we dropped bombs for a long time during unsuccessful phases of the war, the way in which the population behaved was often very different from how it would then behave the minute we helped create forces on the ground, either our own or their own countries, that could then combine with the air power to create some kind of security or some kind of changed battlefield momentum. So I think on the airstrike issue, it all depends. And it just calls out for the need for a fuller strategy than what we've got right now, would be how I would conclude, which I hope is not a bad way to end the whole debate and the whole event. So thank you all for being here very much.